Most people misunderstand leading with love. Most people, even I did when I first heard about it, it does feel soft. And therefore we think, well, I don't want to be that kind of a soft leader, or that's just for a bunch of Christians or a Christian organization. That's the farthest thing from the truth.
This is the L3 Leadership Podcast, episode number 260. Well, hey, podcast family, and welcome to another episode of the L3 Leadership Podcast, where we are obsessed with helping you grow to your maximum potential and to maximize the impact of your leadership. My name is Doug Smith, and I am your host. In today's episode, you'll hear me interview Joel Manby. If you're unfamiliar with Joel, let me just tell you a little bit about him. Joel has been a CEO of major corporations for over 25 years. He's been the CEO of four different companies. One, he was the CEO of SeaWorld. He was the CEO of Hershend Enterprises, which is the largest family-owned theme park and entertainment company in the U.S. He was the CEO of Saab Automobile US, and he was also the CEO of Amazon's car selling partner, which was eventually sold to CarsDirect.com in 2001. He wrote a book called Love Works, which answers the question, can you actually make a profit in business and still love people? And he argues that you can, and it's a phenomenal book. It's actually how I first heard about Joel. Andy Stanley interviewed him on his podcast probably about 10 years ago when the book first came out. And so I picked up a copy of the book, read it. It was phenomenal. It's a must read for business leaders, church leaders, nonprofit leaders. And another fun fact about Joel is he was also on Undercover Boss. And so while I read the book, I also watched the episode. It's a lot of fun to watch. I encourage you to watch it after the interview as well. So that's all you need to know about Joel. In the interview, we talk about a ton of different things. We talk about business. We talk about transitions. We talk about his book, Love Works. And of course, we take him through our lightning round, which you're going to love. So enjoy the interview with Joel. But before we dive into that, here's a few announcements. This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Baritone Advisors. The financial advisors at Baritone Advisors help educate and empower clients to help make informed financial decisions. Find out how Baritone Advisors can help you develop a customized financial plan for your financial future. Please visit their website at Baritone Advisors, that's Beratung advisors.com. Securities and investment products and services offered through Waddell & Reed, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC. Baritone Advisors, Waddell & Reed, and L3 Leadership are separate entities. Hey leader, we tell you all the time here at L3 Leadership that you should never do life alone, but in community. And that's why I want to challenge every single one of you to become a member of L3 Leadership. When you become a member of L3 Leadership, you'll have access to our community of leaders who are willing to encourage you, support you, and hold you accountable for going after your goals. You'll also have access to monthly live webinars that we do with nationally known leaders, monthly Q&A and hot seat hours for our members where you can troubleshoot the issues that you're having with your goal and get live real-time feedback on them to help you develop a plan to overcome those issues. You'll have access to every course that we ever create. You'll have access to every L3 one-day talk we've ever had, and so much more. And all of this is available for just $25 a month. In fact, we believe so much in the product that we are willing to give you your first month for just $1. That's right. If you sign up today at l3leadership.org, your first month of membership is just $1. Leader, don't grow another minute without having a community of leaders to which you can go to and grow with. Sign up today at l3leadership.org. And with all that being said, let's dive right into the interview. Enjoy the interview with Joel Manby. Hey, Joel, thank you so much for being willing to do this interview. As we were just talking, I first connected with you when you were on the Andy Stanley Leadership Podcast many years ago and got to watch your episode on Undercover Boss. And so it's a joy to sit down with you, and I'm anxious to learn from you. But why don't we just start off with you telling us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Sure. Thanks, Doug. It's good to see you again. And it's great to be on your show. I appreciate what you do. In a nutshell, I'm married to Shannon, have father of four wonderful children, and career-wise, I've been a 25-year CEO with four different companies, and from that, just a lot of learning experience that I'm in retirement mode to some degree, but I really want to focus on leading with love and how to help other people and companies do that. And so that's mostly how I spend my time. I'm also chairman of Orange, which is a large nonprofit that services churches. And that's where my passion is as well. So that's a really short answer.
Yeah, you've clearly had a very impressive career. We have a lot of young leaders that listen to this podcast. And I'm just curious, you know, people see what you've been able to accomplish in 25 years in a CEO role. I'm just curious, what do you wish people knew about your leadership journey that they may not know?
Well, one is that I never set out to be a CEO. And I do think, I get trouble sometimes when I hear young people like, that's their goal. You got to be careful what you wish for sometimes, because the tension between home and work and the time that's needed to be a CEO is intense. And I don't care what size company it is. So I'd be careful what you wish for a little bit. I just, I did the very best job in every situation I was in. And I think that's how I got to where I was, and always over delivered. But it wasn't something I sought out.
Wow. And I'm curious along those lines, and you talked about, I'm just curious, what prices have you had to pay to separate yourself throughout your journey to get to even get to that role? And again, not focusing on the destination, but I'm just curious, what do you think made you get out of the pile, so to speak?
Yeah, I think from a skill set standpoint, I'll answer that two ways. One is skill set and one's kind of work ethic. From a skill set standpoint, you know, I did have a good education that helped, no doubt. Went to, you know, private school and then Harvard for business school. Well, it doesn't hurt. But on the other hand, I think where I separate myself is ability to see the future a little bit, and to also very intuitively read situations and have a good anticipation of what's going to go wrong. And a good level of modesty that I don't have all the answers. And I do think a lot of leaders get in trouble, especially entrepreneurial, autocratic type leaders can get in a lot of trouble thinking they always have the right answer. So that's from a skill set standpoint. From a time standpoint, I wasn't always the smartest person in the room, but I was almost always the hardest working person in the room. And as you know, starting your own business is very difficult. Leading any organization is very difficult. And so you have to be willing to commit the time and the effort to do so. So those two are big, big differentiators. But, and not to play off of, you know, the main topic of my book, which is Love Works, is that I did care about my team, my employees. I really sincerely do in my heart care about their life at home, their life at work, because I know that the level of the enthusiasm of our own company will never be higher than the enthusiasm of that worker. And so that's very, very important differentiator in just how I lead compared to what I've seen in some other leaders.
Yeah, I want to get into the book in a minute. And actually, I want to ask you a question that I withdrew from the book. But, you know, you talked about be careful what you wish for. And you talked about the time that's needed to actually lead at the CEO level. And you said at some point in the book, at some point in your career, you asked yourself two questions that I thought were so revealing. You said, it seems like the harder I work and the higher I'm promoted, the worse life gets. Is there any hope of balancing my career goals with family goals? And then you went on to say that my self-esteem is tied up in the performance of the companies I run. Do I really want my emotional highs and lows to be based on quarterly profit reports? And I guess when it comes to leadership, you know, we have a lot of young leaders who do aspire, even if it's not a CEO role, they want to go as far as they can. And in your experience, is it possible to go that route and keep your family? Is that actually a possible thing, or what would you tell
me? It absolutely is. And when I asked myself those questions that you quoted, it was really part of my journey that I didn't mention earlier. The first 20 years of my career, Doug, I was very disenchanted. I was working in the auto industry. I was a believer. I had my faith, but I didn't see it able to be played out in the workplace. And I always had this disenchantment, or what I'd call almost a cognitive dissonance. And it wasn't until I went to Hirsch Entertainment, switched careers from autos to theme parks, and worked with the Hirschens, that I saw that leading with love was possible in a business. And by the way, it had tremendous results from a business standpoint. And I learned that when top leaders and owners feel that way, they also support your family and they support your family time. And there was just a very strong family-oriented culture there that was driven by senior leaders. So yes, it's possible. And I would even argue that, you know, a exhausted leader is not a great leader. A leader who has problems at home, problems with their kids, that all distracts from being a great leader. So it absolutely is possible. But I will say, for 20 years of my career, I didn't think it was possible. And that's part of the reason that I did write the book. It's part of the reason that Undercover Boss, I think, caught on with so many people and resonated with so many people, that a lot of people feel that disenchantment and that dissonance that I talked about.
Yeah, so let's talk to the leader. So that's why you wrote this book. And the first version came out in 2012 and it blew up. And man, I read it, it was extremely impactful. And I think for the first time, a lot of leaders did realize I can lead with love. And you just came out with a new edition with two additional chapters where you talk about some raw things in your leadership and life that I think will add a lot of value to people. And I'm just curious, you know, talk about the book from an 80,000 foot view and then we'll dive in. But why did you write the book and what impact has it had on the leaders that have read it?
Yeah. It's a great question, Doug. At a high level, it started with that dissonance, you know, that I had it and then I finally didn't because the Hirschians modeled it for me. But what really triggered the book is when I was on Undercover Boss, I thought that I might have been the only one feeling that way, the only closet Christian in the secular world who didn't feel I could lead the way I loved and felt. Well, when Undercover Boss happened, 20 million people saw the program, and I literally have books and books filled, notebooks filled with notes and letters and cards from people saying they had the same feeling I did, the same desire to see stronger leaders who cared about them. So then that caused me to write Love Works and then was able to speak on it and help probably, I don't know, 50-some companies implement the same kind of culture. So it all really started from Undercover Boss and then writing the book.
Yeah, and can you talk about what loving people actually looks like? You've trained essentially leaders to love each other. What does that look like in a tactical level from a company standpoint?
Well, it's not easy to implement. It's easy to understand. And because most companies, 90% of the companies out there, Doug, they have their values listed on a chart, on a wall, on a plaque. And I call it, and Cheryl Batchelor as well says, there's a plaque problem out there because people don't back it. So the important thing that's in the book that's non-intuitively obvious is there has to be processes behind it. You have to define the words, whatever they don't have to be the words of love. That's what was in our book. And it's all about, it's taken from Ephesians, 1 Corinthians 13 and the verse on love. But you have to define it. Then you measure it. Top down, bottom up surveys. You talk about the values, and we even put pay plans that reinforce it. You got a better raise if you adhered to the values, as well as hitting your more tactical numbers. What I call do goals versus be goals, and we can talk about that later if you want. But it's that is so important, and that's where only 10% of the companies are trying to have culture change, or even a home. If you're trying to have a culture change in your home. If you're leading anything, the only way that's going to happen is with these processes put in place to kind of put your money where your mouth is, so to speak.
So if someone's listening to this, whether they're an employee or employer and saying, this is the exact opposite of the company that I'm currently working for, or currently leading, would your encouragement be like, hey, if it doesn't already exist, it's going to be too much. If you're a leader, it's too much of an uphill battle. Just go find a culture. And same thing with employee, like would your encouragement be to go find a company that lives and leads their people through love, or try to change the culture that they're in that may be toxic?
That is a great question. And the answers vary. First of all, even if you're in a supportive environment with the right leaders, the right owners, and you're trying to change a culture as part of the team, it's going to take 3 years. So first of all, be patient. And the results that Hirschend or SeaWorld received from leading with love, when we went into turnaround situations, it did take 3 years, and we can go into that more. However, if you're part of an organization and the senior leaders, the owners, just don't believe in it and don't back you on it, my honest answer is to go elsewhere. And I didn't used to say that, but that's what happened to me at SeaWorld. You know, I went in with a plan and the board supported it. And we were making great progress in all regards. It was a very, very difficult turnaround. But a new board member came in who got control of the company, and he didn't agree with that part of it. He just wanted the numbers only, and he wanted them fast. And so he didn't want to wait anymore. And so we got into I waited too long to leave, and I didn't leave on my own accord. It was a mutual decision, and I don't want to paint an incorrect picture. but I tried too long, and I got too much gray hair and too much stress. And so even though every person can play a big part in the culture, I would also say life's too short. And I learned that when I was 40, I would have said, stay and make a difference wherever you are. But if it's toxic, or if it's completely dysfunctional and you're not getting your best delivered, I would seriously think about moving to a different spot when the timing's right.
You mentioned that in a good culture, it would still take 3 years. It's interesting you use that exact, that's very precise. Talk more about that, and I'm just curious, why 3 years?
Yeah, well, if it's already good culture, it'll be less time. But I'll just give you a good example because it's easier to understand a story. We went in, first of all, high level. This is an interesting stat. Gallup has measured for 50 years employee engagement at most companies, many companies. The average engagement score on the top score on the survey is only 30%. So only 30% of workers feel they're totally engaged in the work, which is a horrible figure. It's been pretty consistent for 50 years. When Hersham would go in and buy a property, and it was sometimes as low as 18% top box score, not 30, we consistently took that number to above 70% engagement at every property. And that's world class. That's like Marriott, Apple, they're in those kind of ranges. And what we did is, it's basically exactly what I said earlier. We would go in and they would be taught the values. We'd measure them. We'd talk about them. We had to make changes. Leaders had to go, but we put our money where our mouth is. And if they were delivering the numbers, but doing it in a way that was driving low engagement and high turnover, those people would end up leaving. And that's why it takes long, is it always comes down to leadership, Doug, a good leader, a bad leader. And it takes some time to weed through that, right? You can't replace everybody at one time. You don't have time to do that. So that's really why it took the time to kind of transition to the right leadership team.
So if I'm reading in between the lines, more often than not, it's really just getting the wrong people, the people that shouldn't be in your company, out of the company. And that takes time. Is that pretty consistently just, hey, there's people that are toxic to the culture, they bring it down. And if they're, as long as they're in the organization, no matter what you do, that level of engagement for everyone else is never going to be able to rise. Like, is that pretty consistent with your experience?
That is pretty consistent. You know, I'm painting it maybe more black and white than it always is, because there's other things, right? It takes time to put the processes in place. And that takes time. It takes time to people to understand, what do those seven words of love mean? But to give you an example, like one of the words is patience. We would have three or four values, behaviors of what patience really meant. So it means admonishing in private and praising in public. It means being very specific with your praise, et cetera. It takes time to learn that, right? So yes, the wrong leader's the easy one answer, but I would also say it's time to train and put the processes in place.
Yeah, I want you to talk about admonishment and maybe even firing people, because people hear love works and it's like, oh, that sounds really like cushy. Like, you must just treat everyone fairly and nicely and no one ever gets fired or in trouble. I don't think that's the kind of love you're talking about. Can you just talk about how you viewed admonishment and even how you executed that in the companies that had such a high, highly engaged culture?
Well, you've hit two really important points that I want to make, if you don't mind, Doug. The first, and I'm glad you brought it up. Most people misunderstand leading with love. Most people, even I did when I first heard about it, it does feel soft. And therefore we think, well, I don't want to be that kind of a soft leader, or that's just for a bunch of Christians or a Christian organization. That's the farthest thing from the truth. I've led both ways. I've led in the General Motors world for 20 years. That was strictly what I would call the do goals. And that's just hitting your numbers, hitting the sales, the margin, the profit. But the B goals, that's the seven words of love and what kind of leader do we want to be. Leading that way and holding people accountable is difficult, and it's hard to, you have to have difficult conversations. The other reason people misunderstand it and they think it's soft is, we only have one English word for love. And you said you read the book a while back, so sorry for the repeat, but in the Greek language, there are four different words for love. It's a very complicated word. And most Americans think of love as eros, the erotic, where the word erotic comes from. It's an emotion. That's not what we're talking about at all. The word is agape. It's a Greek word, and it means behavior. It's unconditional. And you just love somebody no matter how they treat you. You forgive them. You treat them with trust and respect and dignity. And that's what ends up having great, great results. So that's very important that people misunderstand that. And I wanted to spend a few moments on that. For your listeners, it's not soft love, it's tough love, if you want to put it that way. As far as admonishment, I did say a couple important points. You'll praise in public and admonish in private. But I think more specifically, when we admonish, what I have learned the hard way by doing it incorrect a lot in the early part of my career is, first of all, be brief in the admonishment. Be very specific. The biggest mistake I see other leaders make is they generalize people. They put them into a category as opposed to, in this situation, you made this specific mistake. And then the third point I'd say is build them back up with some heavy praise, and then put them right back into the situation again, right back on the horse. In the movie Gettysburg, I love that scene. It's an old movie, but when General Lee admonishes Jeb Stuart, and he does it very specifically, he reinforces him, and the next day he's leading in battle again. And I thought it was a perfect example of how we should admonish people. But I would say it's probably one of the weakest things that most leaders have in their repertoire is the ability to confront people, tell them the truth about the situation. But that's leading with love. If we're not doing that, we're not being a loving leader. That's what I would say.
And to follow up on that, I'm just curious, you know, once you admonish someone, if someone's not working out, clearly you talked about getting rid of people who are toxic to the culture. How long will you give someone generally before it's just like, hey, this isn't working, you got to go? Is it, you know, do you let them go for 3 years or three days? Yeah.
That's a tough question. And there's no rule of thumb, honestly. In my experience of doing it way more than I have ever wanted to, if it's a character issue, it happens very quickly. If it's a competence issue, it happens pretty quickly because you figure it out. The chemistry part's harder, you know, if it's just not working for some other reason. But one thing I would say to all leaders is always do it in a way that you would want it done to you. You know, do unto others as you would have it done unto you. So you need to be able to look, we all need to be able to look in the mirror the next morning after it happens and say, I feel I did everything I could. The person wasn't surprised. They had been talked to about the issue. Hopefully it had been documented. They were given an opportunity to succeed and it just didn't happen. Whether it's the do goals or the be goals, neither one of them or one of them was not being hit. But trust me, that comes from doing it the wrong way for one too many times before I learned a lot about the right way.
You made a statement in the book, and actually I've heard Andy Stanley say this, so I don't know if it originated with you or him or vice versa, but I love this. I use this all the time, but I would love to hear you expound on it. The whole statement of some things aren't necessarily problems to be solved. They're tensions to be managed. Can you just talk about that?
I don't know who originated it. Andy and
for today, we'll give you credit. So Andy Stanley stole that from Joel Manby for everyone listening.
No, I think one thing I stole from Andy for sure is do for one what you wish you could do for everyone. And I stole that in the book. You know, I think so many times, but this is true, Doug, isn't it, in life that for some reason we feel like tension's a bad thing and we feel like life should go smoothly. When really there's no example of that, certainly not in the Bible. I mean, look at what happened to the leaders in the Bible that just, even if they were believers in God or Christ, they're followers of Christ, their lives didn't go well. And so we have to manage that tension and just understand that it's going to happen. And I think the way you manage it is really, if I had to pick two words, it's truthful communication and it's trustworthy communication. So we have to be trusting in how we delegate to people. And I would say those are the two biggest important things.
It's very clear through our conversation that you're a person of faith and you're a Christian. And I'm just curious, you know, the book's even based on 1 Corinthians, right? And so I'm just curious, and a lot of times in corporate, it's like, hey, you have to leave your faith at the door. Don't bring that in here. I'm just curious, has that been your experience and how have you lived out your faith in the corporate sector?
Yeah. It, to some degree, it has been the case. You certainly can't proselytize. And you've hit on something really important for people. This is why I'm so passionate about Love Works as a concept, Doug, is because if we think of being Christian as the great commission that we have to basically minister to other people by converting them or getting them to believe in God, you know, only the stats say only 2% of Christians actively evangelize. So that clearly isn't going to hit the spot for most people. But when you think of the number one commandment of loving other people, and that still gets good results, that's something all of us can do in any environment. And we don't have to talk about our Christianity. We have to live it out. And that just means following those words of love, in my opinion. And when I shifted my mindset, you know, so that first 20 years, I kind of was thinking, A, it's not possible, and B, it's all about sharing my faith with people. When I converted to, I am sharing my faith by loving them, and then the faith questions come out of that, and they often do, then my whole perspective on that question changed. I would just really encourage young leaders to think more about the B goals, which are the words of love, and less about the do goals. I feel like that's really where true contentment comes from. And when I have failed on the character side, it had devastating ramifications, and it sticks with you forever. And so I would just encourage people to look at the B goals as the definition of success. And I think that will help eliminate that angst of being in the secular world, because we need Christians in all areas of life. God knows that. And so that's the best answer I can give there.
You were in the entertainment industry for a long time, and obviously it's all about the guest experience. Talk to us about creating great guest experiences. What have you learned?
Well, I mentioned it earlier, but I have to repeat the phrase because it's so key. When you're in any kind of entertainment or frontline business like that, anything that has guest experience, the level of enthusiasm of the guest never rises higher than the enthusiasm of your own employee. And when Jack told me that, it was like bells went off everywhere. I actually never quite saw it that way. In the auto industry, the front line was, especially at dealership level, was treated so poorly. So it kind of reversed the org chart, that the front line's the most important. They need to be supported. They need to be loved. And that is absolutely key in making a great guest experience that's worth repeating. I know it sounds simple, but I am shocked by how many companies I go into or consult with or I'm on the board of that they don't start with what's happening at the front line. They don't start with what their customers are going through. It's always much more theoretical and financially driven. And that's always shocked me. So it's an important point.
Talk to me about thank you notes and leadership.
Yeah, that's one of the great things I learned from Jack is he writes notes all the time. I still get them, even though I left and went to SeaWorld. We remain good friends. I still get notes from Jack. And it's a lost art today, right? Because of email and texting. And I know I sound really old school in saying this, but I would encourage everyone on this phone to break through the clutter and start writing handwritten notes of thanks to people. It will be a gem for them. They'll keep it forever. My kids still have every note I wrote them because they told me and they're in the boxes. But the thing that people don't understand, it's intuitive to see what it'll do to another person, right? It'll encourage them. And none of us get enough encouragement. But if you start the day thinking of yesterday and writing down what happened and thanking people for things you saw yesterday, it puts you in a good frame of mind, puts you in a mind of positivity, and you enter the day that way versus what do we usually do? We pick up the phone, text, emails, things, pressure start to hit us. I just think it's a great way to start your day in a more positive fashion.
Can you talk about, I'm just curious your view on leadership versus management. I had an executive tell me once that management is the path to leadership. Like you have to go through management. I'm just curious, are the two different? And what would your advice be to young leaders on getting, I just want to hear you talk about it.
Well, there's a lot that's been written on that. I actually think they are very different things. Leadership to me, you have to take the responsibility of the vision and where the company or the organization or your family is headed. I think management is more making sure you're hitting the day-to-day numbers, but leadership has the trajectory of 5 to 10 years out. And that is how I look at it differently. Many people are managers, but I think leaders are fewer and farther in between. I do think it can be taught, but I also think a lot of it is kind of genetic, or at least you see it early in life, right? I mean, leaders usually are also captains of their sports teams, or they led the class government at their school. And so I think there is a difference, but it's more that vision looking forward. That's the differentiator.
You talked about leading your family, and we've talked about it earlier in the podcast of, you know, asking this question, can I keep my family and still, you know, be in an executive role? What have you learned about leading your family well throughout the 25 years you were an executive?
Well, I've learned there's two distinct answers to that. And it is just also, I'm going to talk about my quiet time because it's interrelated. But when I've been on my game and I've been proud of who I am, meaning I'm honoring God and who I am, I start with the quiet time. And I start with looking at those seven words of love. And that's defining who I want to be throughout the day. And when I'm doing that, I definitely put my family in the right priority. I don't make some mistakes, but when I'm off my game and I got into some really difficult situations, what I write about in the book about SeaWorld is just the intensity is so high and the demands on time are so great that then I would stop the quiet times. I would get away from focusing on B goals, focusing too much on do and what success might look like and afraid of failure and all the feelings we go through. That's when I get off my game. That's when I get out of balance. That's when I've made the mistakes. And I would just encourage people, you don't have to live out of balance like that. But a routine that keeps you in balance, like for me, it was my quiet time, just find a way to stay on top of that. And I also had an accountability group that I would go to with certain issues, and that helped a lot as well, to be truthful. But when I've made my mistakes is when I wasn't truthful to all people.
A question that I always like to ask leaders, especially that have been in an executive role before, I just want to hear you talk about what you've learned about money throughout your career. I believe if I read correctly, like your family growing up did not have a lot of money. And so you're kind of a first generation executive and having the roles you have, that's correct. But talk to us about what you've learned about money.
I've learned that it's not as important as we think it is. I drove way too much to have money because I did grow up poor. I've asked myself this question 100,000 times. I made so many decisions of where to work or whether to go to another opportunity just because it was more money. Because every fight, every argument in my household growing up was about money. And so I was so bent on not living in my dad's footsteps of not being able to provide enough that causes tension. And so having looked back, I made too many decisions based on that. And yeah, you could say it's easy for some people could say it's easy for me to say because I've been CEO for a long time. So obviously I've built some net worth. I would say, though, in the end of the day, it has nothing to do with happiness. You know, it has everything to do with going after the wrong thing. It is the root of all evil if you look at it wrong. I don't think money in itself is evil, but if it becomes your focus, it can become evil in a hurry. And that's the best I can say on it.
So as you reflect on that, I'm just curious, would you do anything differently if you could start your career over today?
You know, I interestingly enough, I'd still say no, probably not, except I might have stayed at Saab longer. I think I ran from Saab because my wife was putting up the red flag of, hey, you're not home enough, you're traveling 80% of the time. And I think I should have worked harder to make that work, but that really wasn't a monetary issue. It was more just I was too rash and too rushed in leaving Saab to go someplace else to fix a problem that maybe I could have fixed if I had worked harder within the company.
But I want to start to transition to the lightning round. But before we do, is there anything else you want to tell leaders about the revision of the book or anything about what we've been talking about?
I think just that if they, any of them feel that angst that I talked about, or they desire to lead in a different way, I think it would be a fun read for them. All the royalties go to help are a nonprofit, which either helps employees in need, or Orange, which is the ministry I talked about, and just would appreciate any support on it. But I encourage them because it certainly turned my life around.
And we'll include links to all of that in the show notes. So with that being said, let's dive right into the lightning round. Again, just a bunch of fun questions that I love asking all leaders. And the first one is, what is the best advice you've ever received and who gave it to you?
Well, it really was Jack Hirschman on the difference between do goals and be goals. But it was also my mother when she told me that every time I come into contact with somebody, I have a chance to make their day better or worse. And she trained me to make people's day better. And it's just served me really well my whole life. Why leave people feeling down? Leave them feeling up if possible.
If you could put a quote on a billboard for everyone to read, what would it say?
It would say, love others.
What's the best purchase you've made in the last year for $100 or less?
Oh, geez. Actually, it's going to sound conceited, but it was just buying one of these lights for all these Zoom calls so that I can see. Because I'm in my basement and it was so dark I could never see. But they're a great invention. They're a great invention. It's not a very good answer.
Do you have a book that you give away most often or that has impacted you the most deeply?
Other than Love Works, you mean?
Yes, other than Love Works.
that was bad.
No, it's great. Go buy it, everyone. Go buy it. Yeah.
It's certainly the Bible from a book I've actually given the most away. But as far as a leadership book, I would say anything from Jim Collins, especially one that's not as popular called How the Mighty Fall. It's a short read, and it basically says companies die more from indigestion than from kind of lack of ideas, from starvation. And it's just a really good read for leaders who are trying to do too much.
If you listen to podcasts, do you have one or two go-tos?
No, I do listen to Andy. We joked about Andy. And I listen to Brene Brown. I think she's fantastic. And also a guy named Les McEwen. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he's really good on stages of the companies and dealing with visionaries and that kind of thing. So he's really unique.
What are you dreaming about right now and what risks are you taking?
Interestingly enough, I am a pure entrepreneur now, and that I started joelmanby.com, you know, had to invest in the website like you had to do all that years ago, and doing some speaking and writing. And so paying people to help build out that network. And so I'm taking that risk and paying people. I don't have cash flow from it yet other than, you know, book sales. And I find it really, really fun. It's not something I have to do, but I really love it. And I love engaging with people. So I'm trying to build that out and we'll see where it goes.
Do you have a favorite failure in your life that led to a success in the long run?
You mean my own personal failure or other people's?
Yeah, yours. Well, we can go the other one if you want to, but yeah.
But no, I was actually thinking about 3M, how the failure of this glue ended up getting put on stick-em notes and end up being huge profitable product. But for me personally, I haven't talked about it, but my biggest failure that turned to success was really SeaWorld. A few months after I left, the numbers had gone through the roof because they became public. And thank goodness I was able to get out with myself whole, either physically and emotionally, because look what's happened now with the coronavirus, you know, that all those companies are on the brink of bankruptcy, or are they even going to survive? And so at the time, it seemed really difficult, but now it was a blessing. And the numbers did turn for a while, but now with corona, nothing's going very well.
You get to spend time with a lot of high-level leaders. And I'm just curious, do you have one or two go-to questions that you always ask when you get a meeting with someone?
You know, honestly, your questions are fantastic. I'm going to take your list because they are really, really good questions. But I think if I had to answer the one, it would be, what did you learn from failure? So many things are given on, and focused on success. And I think my biggest learnings were from failure. That's why I like the question you just asked. And that's what I think every leader needs to know is we all fail every day. We just have to learn from it and keep moving forward.
What is your biggest leadership pet peeve?
You know, it is lack of clarity. And most people don't give it like they think they give it, and me included, right? And the second would be lack of truthfulness. I think every mistake I've made is when I haven't been truthful with someone or myself, and that's my biggest pet peeve. Especially entrepreneurs have a hard time letting go of things, and they need to be clear what the decision making is and who's doing what, and that helps a lot.
Aside from your family, when you were an executive, what's the greatest investment of your time? I'm just curious, or money. Where did you spend your time that gave you the biggest ROI?
Yeah, within my leadership piece, as far as making me distinct from other leaders I've seen and observed and watched, it is the time I spent focusing on the people side, focusing on making sure they felt included, they felt part of the team. They knew where we were headed, and sometimes to my detriment. And yet that's where I would invest. So if you want to say it was investing in leading with love or the Love Works principles, that's really where I overinvested versus other leaders that I've seen. And I'm not saying they're wrong and I'm right. I'm just saying for me, it worked out fine.
Do you have any unusual habits that enabled you to be successful throughout your career?
I do tend to have really odd hours. Like my most creative time, Doug, is when I'm kind of 11 p.m. to 1 a.m.
And really?
Will
shaking his head. Will's that? Yeah. I'm in bed for like 3 hours at 11 p.m.
Yeah. But I've never been a morning person. I hate mornings, and I don't start meetings till 10 usually because I'm just not on my game yet. So that's unusual. And I think, like I said earlier, the ability to see the future and understand how things are going to go poorly and anticipate that is a pretty good skill set that's served me well.
I'd ask if what my next question was, do you have a morning routine? But it doesn't sound like it. Sleep in.
but honestly, that quiet time point is, I know it sounds cliche, but as a 60-year-old who's older than most of the people on your podcast, I'm sure, if I had to go back and do anything differently, it would be never varying from that and never varying from those 7 words of love. And when I did, I've gotten in trouble and it's hurt me. And I write about that. I don't want to go into it. It's a long story, but I don't want to overstress that. I can't overstress that.
Do you have anything that you've crossed off your bucket list or an experience that you believe everyone needs to experience in their lifetime?
You know, for me, it's just me, right? But going to Italy and driving a Vesper between villages when they have, like, for 10 euros, you get a free glass. You get a glass, you can just go to these different vineyards and taste their wines. And it's so romantic and wonderful. I think Italy is the best country from a bucket list standpoint. But I have a few bucket list items I haven't done, which is I still want to write a song. That's not a parody. I need to write my own real song. And I literally want to perform it live somewhere, like playing a piano bar. I play the piano, and I've just never, my brothers and I had a band, and we played small band concerts or, you know, like dances, but I really want to get in a real legitimate place and draw a paycheck doing that once before I get fired from it.
Well, until you're legitimate, we were talking before we got on this interview, tell people about the video you just made during COVID and we'll provide a link so people have context. Yeah.
If they go to YouTube, there's a video that I did a Johnny Cash impersonation and did his song Folsom Prison, but called it COVID Prison. And it's a parody on this craziness we're all living through on the COVID virus. So if people want to laugh, it's only 3 minutes. Go to YouTube and look. I think it's under my name or under COVID or under Johnny Cash. Hopefully they find it. I'll get you the link and we'll make sure it's there if they have the
intro. We'll find it. We'll find it. If you could go back with and meet with 20-year-old Joel, what would you tell him?
I would tell him, almost get emotional on that one. I would tell him not to worry so much, not to be so stressed and full of anxiety, which... people look at my success sometimes. I think, you know, it's there's still a lot of mistakes, a lot of worrying, a lot of long nights that I probably, in the big picture, just didn't need to happen because none of it really matters. In the end of the day, the closer you get to the end of your life, you know, kind of the fall of your life, the more you realize it is the B goals. You know, it's the character part that you can't get back if you lose it with a friend or a relationship, or whereas the business stuff just comes and goes. It's all dust in the end of the day. It really is. And I know that sounds harsh, but focus on the Beagle. I mean, I love the fact that you have your bride behind you as a picture. I mean, I didn't have enough of that in my life. So that's what I would say.
And you talked about, you know, at the end of the day, at the end of your life, what matters. I'm just curious, what do you want to be remembered for at the end of yours?
Well, the good news is I want to be known for the quality of my character, which I have some work to do with some people because of mistakes I made. Mm-hmm. I want to be known for the quality of my work, and I want to be known for the quality of my friendships. And the thing I would say to encourage people is when you make a mistake, you know, you can't fix it, but all you can do is fix it moving forward. All you can do is learn from it and change going forward. And everyone on this call listening, including you probably, we'll make mistakes, and we'll make mistakes that we wish we had never done. You can spend unnecessary time groveling in the pit of despair, which I did for about 5 years, or you can move forward and focus on who you can be moving forward. And that's the biggest encouragement I make to people who may be in a tough spot right now, or maybe have made mistakes that they're having a hard time overcoming. You have to forgive yourself first before you can expect anybody else to forgive you. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Well, Joel, this has been very, very rich. And is there anything else you want to leave leaders with today?
And I want to encourage you, Doug. I think, you know, the fact that you're a young leader, and I love your program. I love the L3 structure and how you do it. Just keep doing what you're doing, because you guys are the next generation that has to take this world in a much more positive direction than we have been going, it seems like.
We have a little bit of work to do, yeah.
Okay, a little bit of work, but you know what? It's going to get better. It's going to get better. So yes. I appreciate what you do, and just want to encourage you.
Thanks, Joel. This has been phenomenal. So hopefully we'll get to do it again someday. I'd like to thank our sponsor, Henny Jewelers. They're a jeweler owned by my friend and mentor, John Henny. My wife, Laura, and I both got our engagement and our wedding rings at Henny Jewelers, and we absolutely love them. Not only do they have great jewelry, but they also invest in people. In fact, they give every engaged couple a book to help them prepare for their marriage, and we just love that. And so if you're in need of a good jeweler, check out Henny Jewelers at hennyjewelers.com. I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Babb Inc. Babb is an insurance broker, a third-party administrator, and consulting firm led by my friend and mentor, Russell Livingston. Russell is extremely passionate about developing the next generation of leaders, which is why he's partnering with us on this podcast, and he's also opened up his offices here in Pittsburgh to host our monthly leadership events, and we are extremely grateful for that. The nonprofit that I work at, Light of Life Rescue Mission, started using Babb as our insurance broker around 3 years ago, and we've had an unbelievable experience with them, and we highly recommend them. So if you or your organization has any insurance needs, please check out and learn more about Babb at babbins.com. That's BABBINS.com. Well, hey, everyone, thank you so much for listening to our interview with Joel Manby. I hope that you enjoyed it as much as we did. You can find links on ways to connect with Joel and everything we discussed in the show notes at l3leadership.org/260. As always, if this podcast added value to your life, it would mean the world to us if you would share it on social media and let us know what you're taking away from the episodes, and also leave a rating and review on iTunes. It really does help us grow our audience organically, so thank you in advance for that. And as always, I like to end every episode with a quote. And today I will quote John Maxwell. And he said this. He said, "The function of leadership isn't to gather more followers. It's to produce more leaders." So leader, are you producing followers or leaders? If you're not focused on developing leaders, what are you doing? Get out there and start developing leaders. Hey, thank you so much for allowing Laura and I to come into your life. We appreciate you so much. And we will talk to you next episode.